And welcome again to Co-op Radio's Autumn Airlift, special programming for our day on issues around the New World Order. And on this hour, we're looking at Indonesia and the New Order. Not only the New World Order, but the New Order, which was proclaimed by President Suharto a long time ago, and we'll get to that in a moment. But years before George Bush entered the White House, President Suharto declared an Indonesian New Order. Tom Hinkle, who is with us this evening, has recently returned from the region and is here to discuss Southeast Asia's biggest country in the post-Cold War era. And this piece of music we're opening the show with is from Bali, probably the best-known island in Indonesia, in the West, partly, I guess, because it gets a lot of tourism, and it has charming gamelan music. Tom, good evening.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Okay. This sort of music we're used to in the West, is this popular music in Indonesia still? I mean,
this particular piece of music is very popular in Bali. It's based on classical Balinese gamelan music, and consequently has most of its appeal with Balinese people. And you may hear this elsewhere in Indonesia, but this is primarily a Balinese pop music, light pop music piece.
So, Tom, in the intro I said that Indonesia is Southeast Asia's biggest country. But perhaps we can put it into a little more context and just get a sense of you know, how important this country is in geopolitical terms. Like, how does it compare to other countries in the region in size, well, in population and in size?
Well, as you said, it's the largest country in the region. It ranges about 8,000 kilometers from the northern tip of Sumatra in the west all the way to half of New Guinea in the east. And about the same distance between, say, Newfoundland and Queen Charlotte Islands. And those islands number about 20,000 islands with about four or five or six major island groups which contain most of the population. But most of the population is on the island of Bali, the famous Bali. And on the island of Java.
Most of the population, is Bali quite a heavily
and
populated
Java,
island?
Java and Bali make up most of the population, which is not only the largest in Southeast Asia, it's the fifth largest population in the world. So there are a lot of people there, and they are compared to surrounding countries in interesting ways. To their north is the mainland of Asia, and all of these islands stretch between the mainland of Asia and Australia. And they are very different from the Thais or the Chinese or the Vietnamese people. They don't speak a tonal language. Malay-based language is quite different from the Sino languages. But it's very similar to the Filipino language, which is the country to its east.
I suppose another important aspect of Indonesia is that it's predominantly Muslim, right? Like, it's, if I recall...
Yeah, the largest, also the largest Muslim population of any country in the world.
Of any country?
Of any country in the world.
I guess that's true, yeah. Pakistan is not nearly, yeah, right. Which has clearly been a relevant factor in the dodging the government has had to do to remain comfortably in power, assuming it's remained comfortably in power. Though I thought I would like to bring up early on in our conversation what we've been hearing recently from Indonesia. And there's, at least I have seen numerous stories in the local media in the last couple of weeks about a series of really devastating forest fires in the Southeast Asian region generally, but specifically in Indonesia.
Yes, they've been burning for months now and have only recently gotten any attention in the Western media, most recently after Quebec offered to send some firefighting equipment for the Indonesians to look at in case they wanted to buy any to help fight the fires. And in fact, Indonesia has criticized the West for not coming to their aid and terming it an ecological disaster. And complaining that Western nations only bring up the question of ecology in Southeast Asia when it harms the local economy, such as the situation with logging, which is the area where these fires are burning. It's a primary target for logging in Indonesia.
And presumably for investment, well, I know that for some years, the multinational forest companies that are active in British Columbia and in other parts of Canada have been putting a lot of their profits into investing in other parts of the world. And Indonesia has certainly been one of those areas. And I think it would be good if we could get a sense of the degree to which, well, the investments going in and to the which that's affecting the Indonesian economy.
Well, the foreign investment in the forestry sector, which has grown in the last several years to be a big dollar, hard currency dollar earner for Indonesia, that sort of investment has been going on since the mid-70s. And that is definitely a cornerstone. Foreign investment is a cornerstone of President Suharto's Order Baru, which is the new order he established when he and the military came to power in 1966, and was to welcome foreign investment into Indonesia. Companies such as Weyerhaeuser, which is very prominent in British Columbia, although it's a Washington state-based corporation, invested very heavily there. Many smaller companies in Canada that have expertise in such things as plywood manufacture have received contracts in the last couple of years to work with adhesives, for example, when they are setting up plywood factories in Indonesia. Oil is still the largest money earner, oil export, for Indonesia. And Indonesia has been fortunate in having oil to sell. But when the market dropped a few years ago, they quickly scrambled to put money and divert investment into the forestry sector, the non-oil sector, as they refer to it, which means wood, basically. And outside of the Amazon, Indonesia possesses the largest rainforest in the world. And that rainforest, as that in the Amazon, is very much in danger of being clear-cut at the rate things are going currently. There are companies such as the Scott Paper Company, which set up a massive scheme a couple of years ago in Irian Jaya, in far eastern Indonesia. There were protests worldwide about the ecological and human effects of the projected paper mill Scott Paper was planning, and Scott Paper pulled out of it. There have been several success stories in Indonesia where protests, both internally and from outside Indonesia, has forced large corporations to draw back. However, that particular project is still going ahead. Even though Scott Paper has pulled out, its partner in the joint venture in Indonesia is proceeding with that particular project. Those companies which grew since the 70s under the New Order through joint ventures with companies like Weyerhaeuser, like Scott Paper Company, have now built up enough capital that they operate very much as their patrons once did. These companies are massive, these Indonesian, modern Indonesian corporations, and have an enormous amount of money behind them. They are going into areas that have not been clear-cut before, and these are areas in Irian Jaya, as I mentioned, also in Indonesian Borneo, the four provinces of Kalimantan, and logging at a tremendous rate. There's a lot of traditional smallholder logging that's gone on in those areas for a long time, but it has never really altered the ecology such as these massive corporations moving in and cutting. Then when they start to burn the slash afterwards, they face a situation as they did about 3 years ago in East Kalimantan, where an enormous section of that entire province was burned in a big forest fire. Now they're facing it again. Smallholders and others were burning slash, and it's been a very long, extended hot, dry season this year, and those fires got out of control.
Yeah, that's interesting, because what the reports I've read and things I've seen on television about this problem haven't tied sort of the forest economy to this environmental problem. And you're obviously showing that there is a really close correlation. So what you're saying, though, is these indigenous Indonesian forest products companies have grown to the size that they're competing for markets then with the other multinationals.
Yes, one of the larger corporations, which is in part controlled by one of the president's daughters, one of the president's children, the Astra Corporation controls an organization called Burrito Pacific. Burrito Pacific is planning the largest and most modern pulp and paper mill. I think it goes on stream in about 3 years in South Kalimantan province. The output is enormous. Just this one particular woodlot holding of Burrito Pacific. And they will be competing worldwide against pulp and paper from Scandinavia and from North America very handily because of the low standards of forestry management and their low cost of labor.
You referred a number of times already, and I mentioned it in the introduction, to the New Order in Indonesia, which is one of President Suharto's inventions, which I know very little about, but it's surprisingly reminiscent of George Bush's New World Order. And I'd like to talk about that, but I would just like to take a moment to remind people that this evening's program is a part of Autumn Airlift 1991, the time of the year when we ask people to support Co-op Radio and help keep community radio on the air. There's people in the phone room. Our number is 684-8494. Give us a call. Say you'd like to join up or renew your membership, upgrade your membership, make a contribution to keep community radio alive in this part of the world. It's $45 for regular membership, $25 if you're not fully employed or on a pension, and you can pay more if you can afford it. The people in the phone room will explain to you how it's all done, but it's important to keep community radio on the air to keep this sort of programming happening. Today we're having a whole day on the New World Order, and we can only do this stuff with your support, so give us a call. And I'm wondering if in Indonesia you would have stations like Co-op Radio, if there is any alternative media, is there, whether it be print media or electronic media, is it possible for groups who have different sorts of ideas in President Suharto's new order to get a radio station or publish a newspaper or whatever, doing critical analysis of the government of the day?
No.
No, it's
there's
simple enough.
Not any place in the new order for something like Co-op Radio in Indonesia. Media outlets must get licenses from the government, as they must in Canada, but the control mechanisms and requirements are quite much more stringent, shall we say, in Indonesia. If a media outlet, a newspaper or a magazine, for example, prints something that the government doesn't like, they will simply shut the newspaper down. In fact, they may do more than simply shut down your media outlet. There's a very popular magazine in Indonesia, which is a bit of a scandal sheet, which is one reason it's so popular. It's some of the articles are exaggerated. They don't go as far as the checkout rack tabloids that we have here that tell us things like there's new hope for the dead, but they come pretty close. And this one, this magazine ran a popularity contest asking people to write in and say who they thought was more popular. And they published the results and got into a lot of trouble with the government because they ranked Mohammed as 11th. Far below Saddam Hussein, far below even the editor of the magazine himself was apparently voted by people. So the magazine was shut down. The Muslim community was very upset about it. And eventually the editor himself was arrested and jailed. So it's very difficult to do something like Co-op Radio there. However, there have been some small independent radio stations operating under a commercial license in Indonesia, whereas only there has been the state radio, the equivalent of CBC, until just a few years ago, and some very small stations set up by private business people with money are now on the air. And they do a different type of programming, but political analysis is a very touchy sort of thing in Indonesia.
Which I assume relates again to President Suharto's new order, which I understand came about when he took over, when Sukarno was deposed, and Sukarno was moving in a direction that world powers didn't necessarily approve of, and perhaps, you know, internal forces in Indonesia who thought they were going to lose something, and there was tremendous repression at that time. You know, an awful lot of people were killed, and since then, well, I guess it was at that time, right, that Suharto came out with this concept that seems to have been dominant since then.
Yes, even under the previous president, politics in Indonesia had reached a point in the mid-50s where the president more or less banned political parties. And the new order after 1966 under President Suharto continued that, saying that political parties just make for a lot of argument that's against our temperament. The temperament of the Indonesian people is, according to the government, one of consensus. And if we have political parties arguing with each other, as we had in the 50s when we had dozens and dozens of parties, and eventually the Communist Party became very popular in Indonesia, and which was the reason the army overthrew the status quo in 1965 and 66 and established the new order. Political parties were permitted a few years later. There are three political parties. The functioning group, or Golkar, as it's known in Indonesia, which is headed by President Suharto, made up of the military, basically, and those who were involved in taking over the reins of the state in 1966. Golkar was the only party functioning not even under the banner of a party, but as they were called, the functioning group, the ruling group who ran the government at all levels in Indonesia, finally permitted an Islamic party and a third party, the Democratic Party, which is supported by non-Muslims and a few others. Those are the three parties that are permitted. And Golkar has won all of the elections since 1974, when they reinstituted some sort of elections in Indonesia. But political activity is forbidden at the village level. Political parties cannot organize or give out information at the village level. So the grassroots in Indonesia belongs to Golkar, because the government village structure, the medical structure, medical services, educational services, all come from the state, which is dominated by Golkar. And as one head of the medical team from one of this particular region said, that the medical units come in very handy when it comes time for elections in Indonesia.
Yeah, one can certainly imagine that. But at the same time, it's rather surprising that in a country that is so big, that clearly has great inequalities between rich and poor, that is a Muslim country in a world where Muslim fundamentalism and Muslim nationalism of various sorts has been, you know, sweeping through all those the Muslim countries, where in the region that Indonesia is, there's been all kinds of student movements, various uprisings of various sorts, that somehow Suharto, with his new order and with his Golkar party, has been able to keep things quiescent. I mean, how is this done?
Well, in many cases by brute force, as in the case of East Timor in 1976, and more recently, and continuing in East Timor, and also the army was brought down with brute force in Irian Jaya against an independence movement there. More recently, in the northern tip of the island of Sumatra, in Aceh province, the army has come down with all of its might, and the country has been embarrassed with the spectacle of Indonesians fleeing Indonesia to neighboring Malaysia, seeking sanctuary from the army's activities in the province of Aceh. But also simply by the technique of fear. People are afraid in Indonesia to discuss politics, although that is changing very slowly in the last few years. You'll find yourself having interesting conversations with young people that you wouldn't have had before. Hmm. But it's been fear. People disappear in Indonesia for having unpopular views.
So I can understand, I mean, partly what you're saying. If there's no politics allowed in the village level, on the grassroots in the villages, and clearly most of the population is still rural, that would make sort of village uprisings and village movements and the sort of thing that happened during the 50s under the with the communists difficult. But in the big cities, in Jakarta in particular, where you have an ever, as in the underdeveloped world generally, you have large urban centers that are magnets in overcrowded countries to people who are rural, poor, and who are displaced, dispossessed, whatever, and end up in shanty towns in rural in urban areas. These clearly end up posing a threat for the state. Like, is there just constant repression on the urban poor to try and keep things under control?
Well, there is the part of the New Order's economic structure is the basic trickle-down theory, which throws a few scraps to the poor. Their urban situation has changed dramatically in the last few years. 10 years ago, 80% of the population of Indonesia lived in a rural village, and that percentage has shrunk considerably just in the last 3 years through the economic growth that Indonesia has managed to maintain through export of oil and export of its forest. There's been a large increase in not only a dissatisfied urban poor, but also a very mixed up, satisfied, dissatisfied middle class that did not exist before. There is a massive bourgeoisie in urban Indonesia today, from island to island. That is perhaps an equal, if not greater, threat to the status quo of General Suharto's control and the military's control on the country than the urban poor. The urban poor can be dispensed with by the military much more easily than other classes which are more interwoven with the gold car structure. Mm-hmm. And it's that class that has provided a very interesting point of study just in the last 2 years, because these people owe a lot of their success to the New Order's deregulation of the banking industry 3 years ago, for example. So they were able to get credit cards for the first time. And the last 3 years has seen a boom in credit and plastic money that didn't exist before, to the extent that there are massive shopping malls in not only Jakarta, but in all major cities in Indonesia now. It's the mauling of Indonesia, the mauling of the tropics. There's a private television station on in Jakarta now that has advertisements on television for doggy vitamins. And right. Apparently there's a market for it.
Right. Are they importing a lot of goods, or are they trying to emphasize indigenous manufacture? Or are goods like a lot of Japanese and Western consumer goods in the shops?
A lot of import. Mm-hmm. A lot of T-shirts from Japan, for example.
Yeah.
Electronic goods, all Japanese,
right,
as one might expect. Automobiles also. Japan is the largest investor in Indonesia and has been for many years. Although some of the other countries in the region, such as Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore, are in Malaysia even, are putting a lot of money into the country now.
I'd like to continue a little bit more about sort of the shifting economy and some of the other obvious changes that are happening as Indonesia goes through, as the middle class, the proletarianization and the growth of the middle class in this country. But first, we should take a little break. Tom, you brought along some music, and I think we should play so we can get a sense of it. It's interesting, because this is Indonesian pop music. This isn't the stuff you normally hear if you listen to most radio stations, well, any radio station around here who's going to play some Indonesian music. And you're going to hear, I mean, nice enough music, gamelan music from Bali or some other traditional Indonesian music, but this is popular Indonesian music. And so I'd like to remind you that this is Vancouver Cooperative Radio. This is our annual Autumn Airlift, and we're asking you to support Co-op Radio and to call us up and take out a membership or renew your membership if you're already a member. We've had good support. Today has been really great. We've been on the air since 9 o'clock this morning with our special day in New World Order, and I've lost count how many, but we've had lots and lots of phone calls. I don't know, 25, 30 phone calls. And we're well over $1,000 today in terms of pledges that have been made, which is really great. It's nice to see that there's a lot of support for public affairs programming out there. And we're going to be continuing until 11 o'clock this evening. And then at 11 o'clock, we're actually going to have a music show called Out of Order, late night music featuring music that George and Brian wouldn't like. But from now till then, we're going to have a variety of public affairs. Anybody who joins Co-op Radio today will get a copy, if you want, of a tape by Noam Chomsky entitled The U.S. Versus the Third World. And if you want that, tell the operator when you call up to take out a membership or renew your membership. The phone number is 684-8494. So we're going to go now and hear a little bit of this music. Dangut Reggae, Kopi Dang Dut. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that.
Kopi Dang Dut. Dang Dut is a popular music you'll hear in every marketplace and every area frequented by the street kids in cities throughout Indonesia. Dangdut comes from the sound of the traditional classical Indian tabla drum.
Right.
The sound it makes, dangdut, dangdut.
Uh-huh.
And it is very much a fusion music. You'll hear influences not only from India with the percussion section, but from Arabia with some of the flute work and clarinet work, as well as the rhythm section. It's very interesting amalgamation of the different cultural influences on Indonesia expressed musically.
Great. Well, let's hear a little Kopi Dangdut.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Dandut Reggae, a bit of pop music from Indonesia. Very interesting. I haven't heard this stuff before myself. Quite interesting to hear, especially that there was some, like Tom here was pointing out, some English lyrics that were being done in a Jamaican-type accent. So obviously this sort of music, pop music, is happening in Indonesia the same way it is, I mean, similar sorts of stuff, as same as it is in much of the rest of the world, even though they might have some other types of restrictions. We are back on Autumn Airlift Co-op Radio 1991, looking at Indonesia and the New Order. I'd like to remind you that this is our Autumn Airlift, the time of the year when we ask you to support Co-op Radio to help community keep community radio alive in this part of the world. Call 684-8494. There are people in the phone room waiting breathlessly to take your call. 684-8494. The phone room will take all the information, tell you exactly what you have to do, which isn't very much except give your name and a bit of money to keep Co-op Radio on the air. And so we're back now for the final part of this particular part of New World Order Day, looking at Indonesia and the New Order. And Tom, I wanted to ask about your observations. We've been sort of talking about some of the changes that have gone on socially, economically, in terms of the movement of people and so on in Indonesia. But you've been to Indonesia a number of times over the last number of years, and I'd be interested in knowing your own observations when you've been into rural areas as well as in the cities, the sorts of things you've seen shift over those years.
Well, some of the things that have shifted, obviously, is just the basic infrastructure of the country. Roads, bridges, transportation systems have improved, which accounts in some ways for the movement of a lot of these consumer goods down to the village level. That's one of the obvious differences when one goes into rural Indonesia and compares it to, say, 7 or 10 or 12 years ago. I visited this past time in Indonesia two villages that I had lived and worked in previously, one 3 years ago and one 7 years ago. The one 3 years ago was in Sumatra and was a very well-to-do agricultural village of a couple thousand people near markets for their many agricultural crops, but still without running water or without electricity. A recent visit showed electricity has come in. The road has improved somewhat. More people have more consumer goods, more television sets.
Well, I guess with electricity, that opens up a whole possible world of consumer goods.
There were television sets in the village before. There were two of them run off of automobile batteries. But now there are more of them. The electricity is not as we see it in a town in Canada. There's not switches in every room for electric lights and electrical outlets in every house. But there may be one or two in each home. And that's a big difference. Their concerns as a well-to-do rural area hadn't changed very much in the 3 years since I'd been there. There was just more of the same. They were well-to-do anyway. It was quite a different story in rural Borneo, in Kalimantan, with a people known as the Dayaks, the native people of Borneo, which are looked down upon and discriminated against as a minority group by the other Indonesians in the country. A small village of 1,000 people, reachable only by riverboat, 8 hours from the provincial capital. 7 years ago, I was involved helping to organize a consumer cooperative there. The only way consumer goods got to this village were by market boats, big floating barges that would sell everything from kitchenware to stereos.
Oh, it's like a floating market.
Like a floating market boat.
Right, right.
Foodstuffs, kitchenware, hardware, clothing, stereos, radios, what have you. And the prices were outrageous for even basic things such as noodles and rice, soy sauce, chilies. These Dayaks in this village didn't have a large agricultural economic base as those in the village in Sumatra I just described. So the purpose of the cooperative was to allow villagers to buy in bulk and then to sell at a nominal profit to themselves and beat the middleman on the market boat. Mm-hmm. Also, some wells were put in to ensure fresh drinking water, three of them in this village. And as well, the medical unit was spruced up. And a program of weighing the babies in the village was set up with the families, primarily the mothers, to monitor health of the young children in the village. On my recent visit, all of those projects had fallen apart. There was no more cooperative. There were instead three small stores operating out of people's homes in the village. The program for weighing babies had, no one even mentioned it. Still, the doctors and nurses only come every month or 2 months for a one-day visit to this medical building in the village. The school system is still the same school. Children still must go to another town and stay with relatives if they want to go to secondary school and beyond. The oil generator, which ran the electricity on the main street, the only street, for 6 hours a day, had broken down years ago and not been replaced. So things seem to have slid backward in the case of these villagers. People kept asking for medicine. There were a lot of people sick in this village. The richest man in the village, the wealthiest family, which had had the only business before, 7 years ago in this village, of shipping out logs and planks, which villagers cut laboriously with these long cross-cut saws, now has a sawmill where he employs six people in the village to operate a small sawmill. And so the prosperous family in this village is even more prosperous today. And there's a gold mine about a five-hour walk from this village which employs people for just above the minimum wage in Indonesia. So many of the men in the village walk over and work as laborers in the gold mine. And those are the changes I found in that village. The great bourgeois explosion in Jakarta and the urban areas didn't seem to have affected those people's well-being in this Dayak village in central Borneo at all.
So there's not much money coming from the central government, to assist, at least in villages. Well, like you're saying, like this is a Dayak village, and there's going to be some difference there, I'm assuming, from what you're saying. I mean, it's like, you know, traditionally native villages in Canada. I mean, people, you know, native people live in northern Canada until recently anyway, and I'm just not sure today, but certainly until recently they didn't get much of that sort of assistance either, and it's a similar sort of thing, it sounds like.
No, it's a very... It's a situation that does recall some of the grossest exploitation that we've experienced in Canada with our own native people. However, if you compare Canada to Indonesia, on the books, everything looks fine. All these people are looked after. Mind you, they have not been put on reserves as the native people have been here, but they have certainly been exploited. And their situation has not improved along with that of the great middle class in the cities. People have gotten richer in Indonesia, and certainly people, in my experience, seeing those villages, have gotten poorer.
in this part of the country where you were, obviously not in that immediate part of the country, but it's that general part of Indonesia where a lot of the forest industry expansion is going on. And presumably, when that happens, that's going to affect the local village people. I mean, they're going to either become part of the workers in that, or they're just going to be pushed off the land they've been on and have to go somewhere else, because if you have a multinational coming in and cutting out vast swaths of forest, I mean, people who have lived some sort of indigenous lifestyle up the river, along a riverbank, fishing and growing crops and so on, are going to be displaced.
Well, that was going on 7 years ago when I was there, with the government encouraging people to work in the sawmills and encouraging companies to come in and operate sawmills and set up plywood factories and pulp mills. The difference is today, those pulp mills are much bigger. Those plywood factories are far, far bigger than they were 7 years ago, and exporting not raw logs. They did ban shipping of raw logs.
Smarter than we are, huh?
And are turning it into plywood, which they're shipping out. But those people have been gradually, slowly displaced and forced economically and to make some very hard choices over the last few years. And that also has been part of General Suharto's new order, Ordu Baru, in Indonesia.
Right, that's interesting. And this brings me back to another point I was going to bring up earlier, and that was the question of labor. As the forest industries and other industries, but particularly in this case, this vast expansion of the forest industry, which is going to be fairly labor-intensive, creates a much larger and growing working class, and obviously this is going to lead to a larger urban working class, and you're talking about the expansion of urban bourgeoisie, and that's going to lead, or be, not lead, but be part of an expansion of the urban proletariat, and the question is there much organization amongst the working class? Is it possible? You know, trade union activism, right? Is this a factor, or is this also being, like, just kept totally out the way you were talking about freedom of in media being suppressed and the lack of a political opposition?
Well, just as there was no permissible political activity for several years after the new order was established, the same goes for union activity until the mid-80s, when the government did set up a government trade union saying that all workers in industry in Indonesia must belong to the government trade union set up and organized by the government of the new order of Indonesia. Obviously, this union was ineffective in protecting workers' rights. And last September, a year or so ago, a new free trade union was organized in Jakarta, called the Solidarity Free Trade Union, and it was not welcomed at all by the government. They've proved very quickly successful in organizing many of the factories that surround Jakarta. There are now factory satellite towns all around the capital city of Jakarta, where everything from Nike running shoes to high fashion clothing is produced. And these workers very quickly joined the Solidarity Free Trade Union, and the government did become a little alarmed when this trade union not only successfully organized around Jakarta, but began to get the attention of international labor bodies such as the free trade unions organizations based in Geneva, the ILO, for example. The International Labor Organization in Geneva invited a speaker to a conference last spring from this new independent trade union, this very small trade union in Jakarta. And a few days before the Indonesian labor leader was due to leave for this conference, The head of the union was kidnapped on the street and held and interrogated by unidentified men, as the press put it, for 3 days before he was released. The army insists that they had nothing to do with it. The government says they don't know who is responsible for this kidnapping. So clearly, even a small independent trade union such as Solidarity is very quickly intimidated by the tactics of this military government and the new order in Indonesia.
That reminds me of the New World Order, where a small country like Nicaragua can intimidate the United States and get them excited and cause them to do so many outrageous things. There's only 4 minutes left in this hour, which means we have to get out of here and make room for the next program. And we've just sort of touched on a few things. I mean, Indonesia's a really big country. There's all kinds of issues we could get into. But hopefully we've sort of shed light on a few aspects of life today in Indonesia. We've got another piece of music that we're going out on. Mus Mulyadi.
Mus Mulyadi's been popular for, 30 years in Indonesia. And he sings a very special type of Indonesian music, also popular music, called krungchong music. And krungchong music makes use of guitars and almost has a South Seas under the swaying palm trees quality to it. And it is a music that was derived from the very early Portuguese sailors who visited Java in the 1500s and 1600s. So its tradition goes back to Portugal. And the krungchong music is perhaps best sung by Mus Mulyadi.
Okay, we're going to hear a bit of that. And before, I'm going to put that on in just a second, but before I do, I just need to remind you once more, this is Co-op Radio. This is our annual Autumn Airlift. And today we're bringing you a day of special programming to encourage you to support Co-op Radio. This evening, for the last hour, we've been talking about Indonesia and the New Order. In just about 3 minutes, the Voice of Palestine Collective will be in here to do a special one-hour show. At 9 o'clock, there'll be a program called Mulroney's Canada, What Are the Real Consequences of Free Trade? At 10 o'clock will be Noam Chomsky and the U.S. versus the Third World. The U.S. versus the Third World is a tape that we'll be playing, and you can have a copy of that tape if you join Co-op Radio today. Just ask the person in the phone room, and if you join or renew or upgrade your membership, you can have it. The phone number here is 684-8494. I'd like to thank those people who have called. We've had at least one sustaining membership in this last hour and a regular membership, which is really nice, and it's always good to see those phones light up and see you call in 684-8494. Join us. Keep community radio alive in this part of the world. So I'm going to leave you with a bit of Mus Mulyadi, Indonesian music, and which will allow you to get over to your telephones and call 684-8494. Say you want to support Co-op Radio and keep community radio alive in this part of the world.